Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the McClifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, food, glorious food, hot sausage and mustard. Like many of you, I do like my grub. My weight might suggest I like it too much, but such are the hazards of living in a Western country these days. But on a serious note, food is a huge business. We as a nation have come to love to talk about it, to read about it, to watch it on TV, and as your palates have developed, to eat it with greater discernment. But what about our food system? How far these days is the farm from the fork? How many air miles are accumulated in getting your favourite foods to your plate? How are those who produce the food doing in the current system? And is the spin that this country is a great producer and exporter of food anything much more than spin? One well-informed foodie who is across all these issues and writing about it very well, I have to say, in the Irish Examiner, is food writer Joe McNamee. You may have encountered Joe at one of the music festivals or other large gatherings around the country, as he is also a regular fixture at the food stage at these venues. Joe, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Mick.
Joe, I suppose, and from researching to a certain extent, I've seen how complex the food system has become. But in that vein, I was thinking it might be best to reel it back a small bit and remind ourselves how exactly it used to be. Now, I see that you wrote one piece where you referenced, I think it was a producer in Cork, a man named Declan Martin, and how he used to grow and deliver his produce. And would you just tell us about that? I mean, I'd like to just lay it out in terms of this is the way it was, and some people might suggest this is the way it should be, but for various reasons it's not.
Yeah, I suppose it was the way it was to comparatively recently, maybe about the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, where producers were growers still invariably supplied their produce directly to the retailers. And Declan, he was the founder of Waterfall Farms. It's now run by his two sons, Nigel and Trevor. And they supply a lot of restaurants, mostly around Cork these days. And but back then he used to supply cauliflowers, butterhead lettuce, a lot of the staple veg that we would have grown up with in the 70s and 80s. And he supplied to one of the big multiples. And he would fetch up, drive from Waterfall very often in his tractor in the beginning, drive through Bishopstown, pull up at the back door, unload a whole load of cauliflowers, and they would be taken in and put on the shelves and sold. And, you know, business got bigger. He started supplying around the various outlets around the city, bought a van. But eventually the model changed and he found that he had to deliver it to a depot where it was brought up to Athlone, which was the central distribution point, and then sent all the way back down to Cork again. And now Declan wouldn't be the only person that I'd be aware of who would have supplied these big multiples. An awful lot of people would have been involved. I know an apple farmer, he would have done the same thing. And they were constantly fighting a losing battle. They would be bringing in produce. They would be told, oh, you're not getting paid that full amount for that produce because it was damaged. And saying, damaged, where is it? Well, we threw it out. Or it was just ongoing, where the producer was very, very much the second-class citizen in the relationship. And eventually they pulled out entirely because it became far cheaper for them to bring in imported produce from elsewhere in Europe, primarily Britain, actually, for a long time. Trucks would go over to England with dairy produce and meat, beef, lamb, pork, etc. And they'd come back then with the excess that used to be grown by the British multiples to cover their own needs. And that would be sold on Irish shelves. And gradually more and more we lost our own native horticulture sector.
And I suppose that little nugget is instructive, Joe, to the extent, I mean, you're talking about a local producer, and eventually the saying gets that he can't deliver locally, it has to go up the country to come back down the country, and even at that, it doesn't work out, and then we're into imports. And to me, on a very basic level, that would indicate how crazy things have got. The subject of imports in itself, I mean, the average person, well, and I would include myself in this, joint, I just started reading up on this in the last couple of days. The average person might be under the impression that because we project this reputation, and when I say by we, I mean state agencies, Board B, etc., that we're this brilliant producer of foods and we're exporting so much. But as it turns out, an awful lot of the basic foodstuffs that we could and should grow here, we're actually importing them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Pretty much most of the things, bar the exotics. I remember my mother telling me after the war, first experiencing oranges and bananas for the first time and how amazing it was, you know, what a treat it was. Now we just treat those things as everyday staples. That's, you know, that's part of our five a day or breakfast smoothie or whatever we're having. But all these various other fruits and veg that we grow so well in Ireland, we've started to import them as well. I mean, some of the best strawberries in the world are to be found in Ireland. Strawberries don't like to be too hot or too cold. They like the right amount of moisture, the right amount of heat. And we can just do that perfectly. Raspberries, apples for years, for centuries, apples were grown. Superb apples, myriad varieties of heritage apples. They began commercial growing of apples in Ireland at the beginning of the 20th century. And that was hugely successful for the most of the century, for as long as it was done, until gradually now we find that pretty much the only apple available is the French-grown Granny Smith, because it has the longest shelf life of any apple out there.
So why, Joe? Why, particularly in today's world, when there is so much emphasis on traceability, when there is so much emphasis allegedly on sustainability, why is so much imported that we could produce here ourselves?
I think you kind of answered it there with your use of the word allegedly. An awful lot of, like, sustainability is almost a nonsense word now in terms of agriculture and food. It has been so greenwashed. It has been utterly kidnapped by the business of, you know, agribiz, the business of agriculture. It's wheeled out when it's, you know, when it can be used for marketing purposes. But the system that we live in, the food system nationally and globally, is not sustainable. And it's designed to make the biggest profits for the largest forces in the markets, which are the processors and the retailers. And the primary producers are always the ones, these are the farmers and the growers, these are the ones who always suffer and who get the least out of it.
And I saw there a while back, there was a Chagas report that suggested that the reason we were turning so much to imports was because, as a country, we've developed a more sophisticated diet. Would you go along with that?
No. We've certainly developed a more sophisticated diet, and we have travelled, you know, we started in the 70s going abroad, taking package holidays, starting to be gradually exposed to other food cultures. But equally, the supermarkets brought stuff in to us. Most of our education now around food comes from supermarkets and what's available. Like, an indication of how bad things have become is when you have the likes of Chagas starting to make serious attempts at developing the organic sector, at addressing the issues of climate change, at trying to reintroduce native Irish horticulture, trying to bring that back to some semblance of what it was. Because Chagas, for years, to be perfectly honest, have been subservient to the agri-food biz in this country. They have been there to serve, as has the Department of Agriculture, to serve the needs and wishes of big agriculture. And when I talk about agribiz and agriculture, I want to make one thing very, very clear. I'm not talking about most farmers. I think farmers are the biggest victims of all in this whole food system that we have. They're the ones whose incomes are going down in real terms every single year. And yet the profits that are being made from Irish food are just phenomenal. You know, they're growing year on year on year based on state policy. And yet Irish farmers, their income drops year on year on year. So I've always tended to take what Chagas say with a pinch of salt. I think an awful lot of it is that what has been offered to us has, you know, we haven't really had much choice in it. Once upon a time, we shopped in individual independent shops. We went to a butcher, we went to a grocer, we went to a fruit and veg shop. We went to, you know, we went around and we shopped around. When I say we, of course, I'm talking about parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. We shopped around, we compared prices, we knew who had the best prices. Sometimes somebody had the best price for one particular. But, you know, we were very, very good shoppers. We were very canny consumers, and we knew very often even where the produce came from. We knew that it was grown in the hinterland, or at least it came from some other part of Ireland. And then the supermarkets came along, and as well the industrial food processors, and they offered an alternative. And at the time, pretty much all shopping was done by the housewife, who also hand-washed the clothes and so on and so forth. And the supermarket was just another example of convenience. And it was brilliant, freed up so much time. You went to one place, you had this big range of choice. But you gradually, we started to lose the knowledge that we have built up over hundreds of years, even thousands in some cases, and we started to distance ourselves from where food came from, how it was produced, who was producing it. We started to lose sight of that completely, until eventually what we knew about food was what we saw when we walked in to the supermarket and walked around the aisles with our trolleys. That's as much as we knew about food. So People keep talking about the consumer as if the consumer is also to blame because, oh, they buy this, they buy that. The consumer, you know, the consumer only has the choice of what they are presented with. So they have very little that they can do to alter things unless you start to break outside the system, if you start to go to maybe farmers markets or to farm shops or independent retailers. But you know, that's not always accessible to everybody. I remember speaking at a gathering one time, and I was raving about the fabulous farmers markets of Cork, where the farmers market movement in Ireland began. And, you know, I've an option most weeks living in Cork City, even in the city, of going to four or five farmers markets a week. And this woman stood up and she said she's not within 50 miles of a farmer's market, you know, living elsewhere in the country. And that's the same for an awful lot of people. Their only choice is the supermarket.
The other thing about that, Joe, is farmer's market is generally, and I just to show you, there's one where the north side of Dublin, where I am, there was one not far from here, but it's actually closed down because it was unviable, which was a bit of a shock. But the other element to it is, the reality is that the farmer's market is going to be more expensive than the supermarket, and therefore, for people who'd be at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, it's not a realistic option. But I suppose in that vein, are we and have we been conditioned to pay less for food than its real cost?
Let me just go back to the start of what you were saying there about the farmers' markets, because I hear this an awful lot of people saying the farmers' market is so expensive. But have you ever gone to the supermarket shopping and stopped and had a coffee and then maybe had a cake and then maybe had a slice of pizza and then maybe even a crepe or a hot dog or maybe you picked up? And this is what an awful lot of people go to farmers' markets. They spend the morning, they participate in what is a very splendid thing about it, the community, the social aspect, but they're also dropping 10, 20, 30, 40 bucks here, there, left, right and centre. Whereas if you do what I used to do in particular, I used to go to one farmer's market Thursday morning, drop the kids to school, run down to Mahon Point Farmer's Market. I would get my veg, I would get my meat, I would get my cheese, and that's all I would get. I wasn't getting the treats. And in fact, I get the veg. I get far superior Irish veg from, say, Dave Barry at Ballintubber Farm. And I get that for definitely far superior. I'm not sure, say, where I'd get purple sprout and broccoli in a supermarket that would be remotely of the same quality. And it would be about the same price. Maybe Dave's might even be cheaper. Dave might throw me a turnip here. He might throw... All these things gradually add up. So that one about the farmer's market being more expensive, once you dig down a bit, once you're buying directly from the producer who doesn't have to add in a whole load of other costs to get his produce to, say, a supermarket, then in fact it starts to become more comparable. And when you're paying, say, even roughly the same price or slightly more for something that's vastly superior, then the real value is at the farmer's market or some similar alternative. To the second part of the question, there's a report just come in from the UN that estimates that globally we pay 12.7 trillion more for food than it costs.
Wow.
And say we look at our supermarket shelves, for example. Back in 1922, the Consumer Price Weights Index for an Irish household showed that we've spent 57% on food. In 2011, I think it was 10.5%. This is of the household income. And it's not that, people would say, oh, progress has made food become cheaper. It hasn't become cheaper. It's become artificially depressed in price. You have things like the below-cost selling in the supermarkets. You have the whole subsidy system on which CAP is based, the Common Agricultural Policy, which is subsidising all manner of staple foodstuffs that we buy, subsidising the production of it, of some of it. And then you have the secondary costs. You have the cost of a massive industrial-scale food system that has an awful lot of people who have lost their knowledge of food, who have lost that food education, and maybe in that socioeconomic class that really, really struggles to buy food. They're eating the processed foods. They're eating the most inferior foods, which lead to health problems. The biggest killer in the world are the diseases, the non-communicable diseases. And invariably that's related to food. It's like liver disease, kidney disease, heart disease, all related to diet and so on and so forth. So those are more costs. Then there's the cost of transportation. There's the cost of pollution. The 70% of Irish water is destroyed by agriculture, eutrophication, algal blooms. So all these things are adding up more and more. So the cost of food on the shelf is not remotely realistic in real terms.
But, and unfortunately, for a lot of reasons, as they say, that old hackneyed expression, we are where we are. And to the average consumer, between the convenience, the time factor, and to some extent, and I take your point about the farmers' markets, and it's well made actually, because the one that was near here, God, they did some lovely pizzas, and I always put a hole in your pocket when you went down there. But I take your point. But the argument that will be put forward that the consumer decides. I understand what you're saying when you dig down, but to the average consumer, that's precisely what they want for the sake of convenience and everything else. And is there anything in it that greater education or whatever could bring people around to realising exactly how the system works and effectively that we're just pawns in it for big business?
Ooh, we've only got one lifetime, Mick, I reckon. Before we start trying to answer that one, because it is so complex, it's so intertwined. I think the first thing to say is, I don't look back with rose-tinted glasses and go, oh, we need to go back to where it was and it was all fabulous. There are many reasons that we have moved on from there. Farming was and continues to be one of the hardest of all jobs that anybody will do in the developed world, not to mind peasant farming all around the world. you know, and anything at all that can make it easier in some ways or for farmers, you know, is to be welcomed. Consumers at this stage know no different. I think what you're really going to have to start doing is you're going to have to start looking at changing the system overall. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do because the market forces that lead the system don't really want any change at all because they're perfectly happy with the way things are, because they're absolutely happy with the huge, huge profits that they make. And they're perfectly content to pay lip service to things like sustainability, climate change, so on, just as long as the numbers keep going up in the bank account. So where education obviously is important, I mean, education around where food comes from, education on how to even purchase food, education on how to cook food, to start teaching kids in primary school these things and how to cook food would be a massive, massive improvement and would have massive, massive impact. There's an awful lot of growing in schools now. Promoted by GIY, Grow It Yourself, that Waterford NGO, fabulous organisation. And it has been shown, there was a London-based study that showed that of children who grew their own food, 90% of them changed their eating habits for the better. It has a massive, massive impact. But you're going to have to probably some combination of carrot and stick, but who wields the stick? In Ireland, you'd imagine it would be the government, Department of Health, Department of Education, Department of Agriculture. But the Department of Agriculture, by and large, takes its lead from Irish agribiz. Irish politicians currently aren't about to, you know, they're not about to try and change that in any serious way because it comes down to a very simplistic way of viewing things. GDP goes up, there's jobs, there's money, there's taxes. Then you look at a wider European context and you had the new Green Deal, which was, you know, that was radical in EU terms, in terms of what is essentially a very, very slow-moving ship and, you know, so full of bureaucracy, so having to answer to so many masters in so many different countries, and it takes time to achieve these things. So this was a huge, huge thing. And now we've just seen it stripped, gradually stripped away, finally to the Nature Restoration Law, and that was shelved. And that was after a meeting with Copacabana, the organisation that claims to represent 22 million farmers, but actually admits that they don't represent 22 million farmers. They, for the most part, have representatives from big farming organisation and big co-ops, including Irish co-ops, who've long forgotten that their lineage traces back to what Horace Plunkett started. They're just big multinational businesses now at this stage. And they went in, met Ursula von der Leyen and, you know, came out, and that was shelved as well. So I think change is going to have to really come from the bottom, from people on the ground. As the old Terra Madre quote goes, they may be almighty and, you know, hugely, hugely powerful and strong, but we are millions and billions, you know.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
The other thing people would notice, I think, Joe, you'd often see it at some of the odd time at some of the major multiples that they'd advertise that they'd have one particular, for instance, local farmer where they'd locate some of their meat or that kind of thing or some of the other produce. And you'd often see an individual even photographed or what have you. And, you know, you get the impression that it's there to give you the choice of having the local produce. But a lot of that, I think you'd suggest, they tend to be loss leaders and therefore the growers themselves don't reap much reward in that respect.
A couple of things about that. I'll tell you a story about one fella I know who I used to buy regularly from, and he walked into his local supermarket one day. This was one of the non-Irish multiples, and He grabbed a passing manager and he said, that photograph up there. And the guy said, oh, yeah, that's one of our growers, you know, one of our Irish growers. And he said, that's actually me. And he said, oh, yeah. So we take your produce. And he was going, no, I pulled out of it. I decided it wasn't beneficial at all for me to do, you know. And they still had it up. Like, several weeks later, the thing was still up. I was on Ear to the Ground a couple of years ago, and even then they were trying to maybe, it's a great programme, but they were trying to push me into agreeing with the angle that the consumers were to blame for not choosing to buy Irish. And I just keep pushing back, saying it's not the consumers don't have the choice. While we were making that particular episode, we were on a farm down in Ardmore, one of the few surviving horticulture farms. And the lads were telling me they were growing potatoes, parsnips and spuds. But mostly parsnips and carrots, actually. And the lads were saying that they were getting the same prices, literally, just bar exchange between punts and euros as they were getting in the 90s. And that's, you know, think of how much you might have earned in the 90s compared to what you earn now. Think of how much you would have spent in the supermarket then as to compare. So it's no wonder these guys are just frittering away, just, you know, gradually leaving the business or being persuaded to turn their farms into either dairy or livestock.
Yeah, it's a depressing sort of a vista, Joe, that we're all functionaries in this. Of course, on one level, we're all aware of it and it's knowledgeable, but when it's kind of laid out in plain terms there, and also just in terms of what it's doing to our diet. And the other thing, of course, is what it's doing in terms of the planet, because we know there's a huge amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are involved in the global food system. One other element to it that strikes me, food security, which is something we haven't heard much, but with the kind of instability in various aspects of the world at the moment, it's something that more emphasis is placed on. And it just occurs to me that back a few years in the UK following Brexit, do you remember they were short of an awful lot of stuff on the shelves and that sort of thing, and it kind of gave them a major jolt. How's our food security in that respect?
When it comes to fresh produce, fairly shocking. We import, is it? Around about 80% of our fresh produce at this stage. I remember the Toronto Food Policy Council a number of years ago did a study, and they estimated that most major conurbations, most major cities, and Ireland is small enough and really connected enough to almost go, look, it's a couple of, you know, it's a major city or a small major city and a bunch of major towns, but we are small enough that, and we're also an island, that you could take us in a similar vein. They said in the event of something truly disastrous, like an earthquake or a nuclear war, and a nuclear war, when they first started talking about it, would have been ridiculous. Now it's this little unspoken thing at the back of all our minds as we watch what's happening, what's playing out in Ukraine. But say a localised nuclear war, if the war in Europe spilled over, we would have really supplies for just a matter of days of fresh produce. We have long ago lost the ability to feed ourselves on our own fresh ground produce. It's estimated that around the world, there's the world grain reserves, you know, primarily wheat, but also rice. It's estimated that there's about a 3 month reserve. You see in a lot of the sort of Middle Eastern or African countries, sometimes particularly North Africa, when there's food riots, generally it tends to start around when bread becomes scarce. You look what happened to us when we had that bit of snow and we couldn't get the old sliced pan. When the beginning of the pandemic, when the shops were just denuded of flour, there's a whole host of things that we couldn't supply ourselves with literally after days, weeks at most. So food security, we're doing very, very poorly.
And another thing I think that might surprise, it surprised me anyway, was I noticed that we export roughly the same amount of fish as we import, and us being an island economy, and the stuff we export is of far greater quality than that we import.
We produce some of the very, very best seafood in the world. Now, we don't have a fabulous tradition of eating it, as for a number of reasons. I suppose the Lenten fish, all that sort of that history
has
been passed on, you know, sort of leaves its mark, and parents aren't inclined to cook it for children who, so all they know about Lent now is that, you know, at the end of it, they get a massive supply of chocolate. But you often hear Irish people, and they kind of come back from holidays, you know why I would eat fish? I tell you, I'd eat fish if I could get fish as good as I had on that little holiday when I was on the pier in Marseillais in the south of France, or I was there, oh, I was in this lovely little spot in Spain, or I was in Italy, and I got beautiful shellfish along the Cinque Terre or whatever, and they're all raving about this, and there's a really, really, really good chance that they were eating Irish fish or Irish shellfish or Irish seafood, because the French and Spanish supermarkets are the biggest bulk purchasers of Irish caught fish. They take it all. There's loads and loads of the oysters, mussels, all sorts of other shellfish. They head off as well, off to mainland Europe. And what we bring in then is, you know, like loads of tinned tuna. We bring in, we have fabulous prawns, and yet we buy these tiger prawns that are raised in farms in Vietnam, downriver from where they raise the chickens that make up so much of that, those cheap chicken nuggets that we have in the supermarket. And these chickens are crapping into the river, which is going downriver to these tiger prawns, which are, you know, hugely inferior. But the reason we buy those is because they're much more convenient. They're packaged. We don't have to maybe necessarily go to a fishmonger and get him to do the stuff. And they're also way, way cheaper because they're in industrial quantities. So it's just another example. And, you know, what's behind that? The fact that nobody knows really what's going on anymore. And if you don't know, it's very hard to care.
Yeah, that's a fair point. All right. And just finally, Joe, so do you envisage any pushback, any moderation of the system, any realisation at a political level that this is not serving the best interests of the citizens in general?
I think I've said this to you before in the past, that every single citizen in a utopia, their first vote would be, I suppose in a utopia would be irrelevant anyway, but their first vote should be for a Green Party. But I feel that the Green Party have failed in their communication, their messaging to, you know, probably the most important native indigenous industry, which is agriculture and the farmers, that they have failed to communicate to the farmers that their message really comes from the same place where the farmers The farmers now I'm talking about. I'm not talking about industrial processors or retailers or anything like that. I'm just talking about the farmers, that they really should be on the same side of the fence, because they both want exactly the same thing. They both want to restore the land. I mean, there's a concept now, people are talking less about sustainability or, I mean, sorry, I'm not sidetracking too much now, but sustainability means sustaining something. Why would you want to sustain something when the land is a chemical cocktail, when it's absolutely useless in many, many parts of the country without huge, huge inputs of artificial fertilisers, which are then going on to destroy our waters? Why do you want to sustain that? What we should be talking about is, the big thing is regenerative agriculture, which regenerates the land and the waters, brings them back to their ideal state. And then we could start developing something called resilience. Now, farming is going to have to go through massive, massive changes, and it should be guided by the Department of Agriculture and by Chagask, but not by the industrial processors or the giant retailers. Farming is going to have to change hugely to adapt to the conditions that we now have under climate change. We've just had the wettest March in history, is it? In recorded history. That means a huge thing. Farmers still haven't been able to get cattle out to grass. They still haven't been able to start sowing for, summer harvesting. And an awful lot of the reason for that is the system that they have been working in up to now has been causing this climate change. So there's going to have to be massive change. When you get to a situation where you're being forced into it by circumstances, by such extreme weather events in Ireland and all around the world, then you have to start wondering, is it too late? And then that's where you sort of make your choice. Do you give up or do you keep fighting? And I think it's an innate human quality to keep fighting, to keep striving. And we can do some amazing things. We have some amazing resources, potential for innovation. And that's, it needs to be, we need to combine sort of being completely unafraid of embracing change and working towards as much innovation in agriculture as is possible.
Yeah. It's an interesting picture, all right, Joe. And one, as you say, I think change is going to be forced on us, as it is in so many other ways, due to, among other things, of course, climate change. But it's something we'll keep an eye on, even if you have ruined my lunch. But that's another matter. Joe, listen, very interesting. Thank you very much. Joe McNamee, food writer with the Irish Examiner, and you can read his stuff in the paper. And I have to say, folks, it is an area that is very interesting and one we need to pay far more attention to and hopefully bring about some kind of positive change that's going to benefit us all. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Meg.
Also, like to thank, as always, engineer JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening. We'll be back with you soon. Take it easy in the meantime.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.